Hello, I'm still trying to work out my switch here. There we go. First of all, I'd very much like to thank all the trustees of the Onassis Foundation, but of course especially Dr. Papadimitriou and the academic organisers of this extraordinary event, Dr. Babiniotis and Niki Tsironis. It's been quite inspiring. There are so many links going on between the different papers that my mind is actually buzzing, so I'm going to have to be quite strict and read out my paper. Now, ancient Greek drama is performed in every continent of the world, from Manipur in northeast India to Melbourne, Australia, from Bolivia to Peking, from Newfoundland to the Transvaal, Tokyo to Montreal, St. Petersburg to Buenos Aires, and of course, repeatedly in Delphi, Thessaloniki, Epidavros, and Athens. It's performed by Palestinian Arabs and Israelis, by Greeks, Cypriots, and Turks, by Bosnians, Serbs, and Croats, and by both Catholics and Protestants in Ireland. More than any other classics in the repertoire of world theatre performance, the plays first composed in ancient Greek have proven their ability to migrate between languages, cultures, religions, and extraordinarily contingent political circumstances. Over the last three or four decades, all the plays, every single one of the plays by Aeschylus, Sophocles, Aristophanes, and Euripides have been performed, and in every continent of the world. They've travelled and penetrated culturally just as far as the works of the other two ancient Greek authors who just quantitatively have been translated into most languages, and that's actually Homer and Aesop, the man that Socrates translated, put into verse in prison. And they've been experienced in performance, whether live or on screen, more than either Aesop or Homer. But in fact, the increasing globalization of these ancient plays presents to any theatre specialists an intriguing theoretical problem. There we have two of the great Japanese so-called intercultural performances. We saw some amazing clips earlier from Yukio Ninagawa's Medea. And on the other side, I have Suzuki Tadashi's Electra, this very possibility of intercultural performance where different Eastern theatre performance styles meet ancient Greek theatre texts is really quite remarkable. If you're interested in post-colonial theatre theory. The other one I'm going to show is one of my favourite performances ever, Yael Farber's Melora, a couple of years ago, which is a South African Oris Dia of quite extraordinary power, where the chorus made sense to me as never before through the actual choral collective ritual dances of Zulus. Now, one explanation for this extraordinary flexibility is just aesthetic. Poets, translators, and composers like to experiment in an avant-garde way with elevated verse drama and the ancient oral form. Theatre directors, designers, actors, and dramatists have all been engaged in postmodern experiments in the electronic age, and they found extraordinary inspiration in the ancient Greek tragedians, people like Heiner Müller in the use of video and in split screens and in very meta-theatrical effects. Here, a quite important film of the Antigone by Straub, where we had the actual clackerboard inside to represent messenger speeches and so on. And of course, the recent prominence of Greek tragedy is very much connected with what theatre theorists call the performative turn. And people started to dislike intensely the 19th century proscenium arch. We've almost got a proscenium arch here. We've certainly got some curtains. And as they looked at different kinds of performance space, whether open air parks or factories, or recently I was at a performance in a British military camp, an army camp, of the Persians, then the out-of-door performance space of the ancient Greeks proved very, very fascinating. I was consultant on this extraordinary production in Braunschweig in Germany a couple of years ago by the director Claudia Bosse, which took place in a warehouse, but it was in Braunschweig, which was the city that gave Adolf Hitler, who was Austrian, his German citizenship, and the whole thing took on an extraordinarily charged atmosphere as a result. And of course, Greek tragic ethics is another argument. Aesthetics is one, ethics is another. The Greek tragedies that tackle issues about sex, sexuality, about parenthood, and about crime and punishment, and especially revenge, with an honesty which we could all do with thinking about now. I think in particular of Peter Sellers' Children of Heracles, an extraordinary play which actually thinks very, very hard about the need for revenge on the part of victims of any form of persecution, as well as the more political role of asylum seekers. There are also, of course, metaphysical reasons, and this is actually one of my favourite explanations, though it's the one least often used. I think there's something about a place where you can go with people of any religion or no religion to watch discussions of the really big questions about life and death and our place as little tiny human beings in an inexplicable universe. I think that the Greek theatre has proved extraordinarily attractive because not very many people, there are a few I gather in Greece, actually worship the Olympian gods with any great conviction anymore. It's a place where you can go which does not have the baggage that, say, going to Renaissance Christian revenge tragedy has. And I think this is what going to be, in the third millennium, one of the most important reasons why Greek theatre is going to be performed more and more and more. We need a religious space that isn't the religion of any of us. Now, Greek theatre was also, of course, born in a moment of completely revolutionary change, and directors have been galvanised by its political potential. And this is the sort of thing that we're most familiar with. Antigone, the heroine of Sophocles, is a hardy perennial. She's protested against persecution in South Africa, Latin America, Jakarta, Ireland, Poland, almost every country where there has been such persecution. In Euripides' war plays, there's been discovered incredible relevance lately with Trojan women, Persians, and Iphigenia in Aulis, all enjoying notable revivals. But one of the things that really worries me is that I go to a lot of conferences with my drama hat on, where the big issue is something called post-colonialism. And that is where people, I was at one last week, where a large number of very distinguished Africanists were discussing whether the plays of the Western canon of the Western imperialism, of the Western domination of the planet, which of course is not something that Greece has tried to do very hard, but which my own country, Britain, and France, and Spain, and Portugal, and Holland have all been very guilty of. Can these texts, which were the curriculum, the repertoire, the syllabus of European domination of the planet, ever be truly global without really great big problems attached to that? Isn't it just to spread domination of the planet? And this is, if you are an African dramatist like Femi Oshofisan, who is the most important playwright in Nigeria, and wrote a wonderful version of Antigone called Tegoni, which is a Nigerian Yoruba version, is very, very much interested in. He thinks you can decolonize, take the colonizational mindset out of the ancient texts. And in the last part of this paper, I want to think about a particular tragedy and the historical uses which it's been put to. I'm a practitioner insofar as I have lots of friends who are playwrights and try to encourage them to put plays on. And what I want to see, and have got some way towards organising, is a new version of the Iphigenia en Tavris, the Iphigenia amongst the Taurians, in Tauris, which is, of course, the Crimea. It's Sevastopol. It's like 1 mile from the great military naval base at Sevastopol in June, July 2012, just before the next Olympics. This particular play fascinates me because it's a symbolic mediation on the potential of intercultural contact. Of all the Greek tragedies, it's the one that's most plainly about how one culture talks to another and tries to negotiate a settlement. Now, it's written when the Athenians were building communities in the Black Sea, but the planned productions that I want to see would actually allow the Taurian Artemis, this is the Artemis who comes from Tauris to Halae and Brauron in Attica, to move between Greece and the rest of the world in a performance of great beauty and emotional power. Now, at the end of Euripides' play, you actually have diplomatic harmony. An international sort of truce is declared by Athena on an international and cosmic level. The Greek boys, Orestes and Pylades, who've escaped human sacrifice in the Taurians' temple of Artemis in the southwest Crimea, are to be allowed to return safely to Greece along with Iphigenia. And the chorus of Greek women, attendants of Iphigenia at the sanctuary of the Tauric Artemis, are later to be rescued and returned to Greece themselves. The Taurians are to live on peacefully. Nobody's actually dead. And they allow the Greeks to leave, along with the statue of Artemis, which, in honour of one of our other speakers, is a vase in Basel. And you can see the statue of Artemis on the top of the pillar. This is the one that's brought to Greece from the Black Sea. And in different ways, both the Greeks and the barbarians are going to adjust how they worship this particular goddess. In fact, I think that Euripides in some ways suggests that Thoas of the Tauri and his men are more morally superior to the Greeks. It's an extraordinary play when Iphigenia says she's got to wash Orestes and Pylades and the statue because they're polluted. And Thoas says, why? And she says, well, they killed their mother. He says, good God, by Apollo, even a barbarian wouldn't do that, right? So he's got this idea that kin murder that the Greeks get up to is really shocking. At least they only kill their enemies. Now, since the Crimea was from the Renaissance until Catherine the Great, ruled by the Ottoman Khans, many, many versions and adaptations of the tragedy all the way through that period, like the Gluck version and the Goethe version and many, many others, were actually horribly racist. Thoas tended to get turned into a Turkish pasha, like a Khan, and his chorus were thoroughly turned into Scythians, and they were all murdered by Orestes and Pylades, and the play was interpreted consistently as the triumph of Christianity over a corrupt Islamic pasha's palace. Why I want to put on the Euripides play is because it's so much less racist than that. It is so much more powerful. Euripides makes his Iphigenia hold Thoas in great respect. When Orestes says, let's kill the king, Iphigenia says, for heaven's sake, you know, grow up, you know, he's been good to me. When Orestes suggests, like, invading the temple and stealing the statue, they say, no, you can't, you're not allowed to touch this statue, it's sacred, only the priestess Iphigenia can touch her. And I think this production of Euripides' play, it would actually help to heal some of the wounds of colonialism, to heal some of the wounds of history, especially if it was performed both in Greece, in Attica, possibly Delphi, where Orestes was given the order by Apollo, of course, to go to the Black Sea, and certainly in the Black Sea itself. This play is the undiscovered salve. It's a sort of medicine for the post-colonial era. It's the archetypal dramatization of an encounter between different ethnic groups on a faraway coast, very much the Greek equivalent of the Tempest. The encounter begins with mutual suspicion and violence and the threat of death to the Greeks who've arrived on foreign soil, but the conflict is resolved and the old psychological wounds are healed. Moreover, the ending celebrates the positive aspects of cultural exchange. Thoas and his Taurians agree to let the Greeks go in peace, and Greek religion is very much enriched by its contact with the Taurians' cult of Artemis. And I actually think Thoas is the unsung hero. Here he is in a production in a British school in the 1950s. He is a very gracious king who very much admires the Greeks. I was going to tell you a story about my hero, Michael. It's actually Dorizas, not Dorizos. Who played in this wonderful play at the University of Pennsylvania in 1915, because he is the great hero of Greek cosmopolitanism, which is what I think this play advocates. Born in 1890 in Constantinople, In 1907, he set a world record for the javelin. In 1908, he won the silver medal at the London Olympics. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, was officially declared the strongest man ever to attend the University of Pennsylvania, and broke a strength testing machine, and did heavyweight boxing for the university. And he starred in that play before serving in the US Army in France in World War II, and then worked as an interpreter at the Paris Peace Conference before lecturing on Greco-Turkish geography all over the world. What an Onassis man. Now, I want to get this play put on, and I have persuaded my hero, Tony Harrison, who was mentioned this morning by Richard Buxton, that this is the play that he wants to do now. He did the Oristara in 1980, where Iphigenia's sacrifice caused everything. I persuaded him he wants to do it. I've also found him a home in my college at London University and a small stipend to write this. Currently, he's just starting now, just after Christmas. And what we want to do is play the play at the National Theatre in London, who've already expressed interest, then come to Greece, maybe even play it at Brauron, maybe play it in Athens, and then take that statue of Artemis to the northernmost theatre of the ancient Greeks ever discovered, which is in, guess where, Tauris. It's in the Tauric Chersonese, 1 mile from Sebastopol. That church in the background is built where the actual sanctuary of Artemis once stood. It is a performance space that can be used. We've got permission from the people who've been digging it up, which is a combined Ukrainian and University of Texas at Austin enterprise. We want to do it in 2012 because that will be the 100th anniversary of an incredibly important production. In fact, probably the first, certainly the first in English, in the translation of Gilbert Murray, the great Hellenist and co-founder of the League of Nations, later the United Nations, a true internationalist. I'm actually chairman of the Gilbert Murray Trust, and I have discovered exactly when he became converted to true internationalism, and it was when some British men who did not want to fight, and pacifists, were very badly treated in the First World War. And it was that sort of time that he was producing his amazing Iphigenia amongst the Taurians on tour in America. So I would like it to be the anniversary of the 1912 production. I would also like it to be just before the Olympics, to get lots of media attention on the interchange of the statue going to and fro between Greece and the world, Greek and what used to be called barbarian, at a time when the sort of rampant nationalism that I rather dislike, which is associated with the Olympics, another great legacy of ancient Greece. I would like to do a production that said, we Greeks, our legacy does not have to be that kind of nationalism. It can be a meditation on diaspora and on intercultural exchange. Thank you very much.